Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, an environmental group is putting New York State lawmakers on the record with its 2026 environmental scorecard, tracking votes on climate, clean water, data centers, and more. We'll hear what the scores reveal about where lawmakers stand and what happened when New York's landmark climate law was weakened this year. A few mysteries from the worlds of science and history. What can a 2,300-year-old batch of beer tell us about ancient brewing? Can butterflies carry memories from their caterpillar days? Or even pass those experiences on to their offspring? It's Science Stories with Joe Johnson. Plus, a taste of the coast in the Catskills. We're eating upstate at Oyster Party in Woodstock. And a unique national project connecting strangers across America. That's all coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump's envoy and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, says he's optimistic about his plan for Gaza. He was in Israel yesterday, meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, this after a rare meeting over the weekend with Hamas leaders in Egypt. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more.
He said it's, quote, hard to trust a terrorist organization that committed what he called terrible atrocities, but he said the Hamas officials said all the right things. Then Kushner went to Israel and met Netanyahu. He said the meeting lasted nearly 4 hours. They pored over the details of a new U.S.-backed roadmap for how to move forward in Gaza. Netanyahu initially rejected that roadmap for Israeli withdrawal from Gaza alongside Hamas disarmament. But Kushner said he sat with Netanyahu and his team and talked through what he called misunderstandings and misinformation about the plan.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. Ukraine says Russia has no plans for a ceasefire or to sign a peace agreement by the end of this year, and says Moscow plans to continue advancing on the front lines and target key infrastructure. NPR's Hanna Palomarenko has more.
In an interview with Ukrainian media, Vadim Skibitsky, deputy head of the General Intelligence Directorate of the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, said that according to intelligence reports, Moscow plans to continue its offensive operations and intensify attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure. He noted that electricity and heating will remain the most vulnerable during the winter and that gas infrastructure is also at risk. On the front lines, according to Skibitsky, the Russian General Staff's plan include completing the capture of the Donetsk region by the end of this year. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Pentagon ordered 30 U.S. universities to conduct audits of their ties to foreign entities or risk losing federal research dollars. As NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports, the administration is targeting connections with China, Russia, and Iran.
The Trump administration has highlighted partnerships with and funding from foreign organizations in the past in an attempt to root out what it sees as foreign influence. These latest audits follow the same goal. The administration said the scrutiny is to protect national security, warding off, quote, intellectual property theft and adversarial exploitation. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Education created an online dashboard to track foreign gifts and contracts. It shows Harvard University receiving the most foreign gifts, with China as the leading source. Harvard was among the 30 universities asked to do a new audit, along with New York University and MIT. The universities have not provided comment on the request. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Wall Street's trading lower at this hour. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Disney is suing the FCC, alleging it's violating its First Amendment rights by challenging its ABC broadcast licenses and investigating the network's talk show The View. Disney says the administration is waging a retaliatory campaign against ABC because it doesn't approve of what it broadcasts. The suit cites social media posts by President Trump urging that ABC be stripped of its broadcast licenses because of its news coverage and remarks by late-night host Jimmy Kimmel. In April, the FCC ordered Disney and the eight ABC stations it owns to renew broadcast licenses early as it investigated The View along with Disney's DEI policies. An erectile dysfunction drug is getting more buzz in wellness circles. Cialis is being promoted for longevity. NPR's Will Stone reports.
Online clinics and influencers are promoting tadalafil as a kind of all-purpose longevity drug. It belongs to the same class of drugs as Viagra. There is research suggesting tadalafil could have benefits for blood vessels and that men taking it are at a lower risk of dying from cardiovascular-related causes. Dr. Robert Kloner at the Huntington Medical Research Institute has been studying this.
We found an association. We found a signal. This does not prove causation.
To do that, Kloner says there would need to be high-quality human trials. Along with erectile dysfunction, tadalafil is approved for a rare form of high blood pressure affecting the lungs, as well as symptoms of enlarged prostate in men. Will Stone, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 46 points, the NASDAQ down 305 points, S&P 500 down 37. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. A new legislative scorecard released from environmental justice group Environmental Advocates New York details how every state lawmaker voted on key environmental bills this year. The report comes after New York Governor Kathy Hochul weakened the state's landmark climate law this past May as part of the state budget. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Vanessa Fagens, Executive Director of Environmental Advocates New York, about what the scorecard tells us on where lawmakers stand on the environment.
The Environmental Advocates New York just released its 2026 legislative scorecard this week. This is the organization's annual account of how the state's lawmakers voted on environmental issues. Would love to just start with hearing what were some of the biggest findings that stood out to you.
I think the reason we do this scorecard is because I like to remind people, legislators have a power that the rest of us mere mortals don't have. They can vote. And what we do with our scorecard is track how everybody we elect to office to serve in New York State uses their vote to protect and conserve our environment, our water, and our clean air and climate. And there are 213 legislators in Albany. And what we did this year was, of course, not only track all of their votes, but we did a little something extra, which was also see how legislators used their public platform, something that is more pronounced than many of us have as well because of their status as public officials, to speak out about their views about what happened to the biggest environmental story of the year, the weakening of New York State's climate law. And that's the sort of top line here that I think is important to look at. If we look at things by the numbers, 37 out of 213 legislators earned 3 points, which was as many as you could get, for using their platforms just to say anything about the climate law and that it was problematic, that it was being weakened. That, in my mind, is a pretty big story and headline. But we also have 73 legislators speaking up publicly in some fashion, supporting the climate law, even though and even as it was being weakened. So that's still, that's a big story. We see big numbers coming out of that. We also can see big stories like the fact that we saw zero of four super bills, which is a designation environmental advocates uses alongside many partners to indicate bills that have super importance and great consensus across the environmental movement. Zero of those four bills made it to the floor for a vote in the assembly this year. Now, there are good headlines, too, but this was a pretty bellwether year. And I think another thing that's interesting is the year didn't have to go like this. There are a lot of headwinds, for sure, that are facing Albany lawmakers. problems with affordability and super concerns about energy costs. But had people decided to vote and lean in other directions, the solutions and offerings and programming and spending that could come from things like the climate law and super bills could also have helped address just those concerns.
And you talked about the 2019 landmark climate law. New York Governor Kathy Hochul rolled back some of those mandates from that climate law. And the scorecard release, as you described, outlines which lawmakers, both from the Assembly and the Senate, stood up and pushed back and potentially even voted to oppose those rollbacks. For our listeners, just as a reminder, the former mandate back in 2019 outlined a 100% zero emission energy by 2040. That was amended in the latest state budget. Now the state is moving forward with a goal of reducing emissions to, I believe, 60% of 1990 levels by 2040. I'm curious, Vanessa, if you could talk a little bit about just how significant this decision is and what kind of long-term implications you think this might set for next year's state budget and legislative session.
Absolutely. We still have a climate law. I like to remind people of that. This was not a repeal. It was a weakening by extending the deadlines. And that's something, in my mind, that helps polluters, not households. What the climate law is designed to do is to transfer the cost of pollution to the people who are polluting and away from taxpayers. And the longer we delay in doing that, the longer we as households and taxpayers bear the brunt of that cost. Now, there are lots of complications and ways that costs can be passed on. But the implication of this is we're waiting 2 more years to see incentives for companies to not only reduce their emissions, but pay to pollute, which produces revenue for the state of New York to reinvest in our communities and in our climate. For example, a third of the money that the climate law was supposed to produce, about $1 billion this year, had it gone into effect as previously planned in 2026, was allocated for energy bill, utility bill relief. Now, that happened to be one of the major stories of the year as well. Had we had $1 billion for New Yorkers' energy bill relief, I think the experience with soaring energy prices would have been very different. And so I think when we look at it that way, we can understand there are costs to our pocketbooks. But of course, the longer we delay to reduce our emissions, the more ramifications we will see for our climate and the more expensive it is to clean things up down the road.
I want to talk a little bit about our region. Let's take a closer look at the region in the Catskills and Hudson Valley area, how the Senate and Assembly in our neck of the woods voted on some of these environmental bills in the region, and kind of just what stuck out to you overall about this region.
We always want to elevate and celebrate so many of our friends and allies from the region that this station reaches. We do a lot of work with not only the assembly members and senators from the Catskills and Hudson Valley, but also many partner organizations like Catskill Mountain Keeper and many others that are based with you, River Keeper, et cetera. Certainly, always want to give a shout out to some of the top scorers on our scorecard, like Senator Michelle Hinchey, who received top marks for speaking out against what was happening with the climate law and has done a lot of work in and around many of the bills that we supported, memoed, and were advocating for this year. And I think one of the other big stories here is that a lot of the immediate impacts that we are seeing as a result of climate change have been felt in your region in particular this year. Landmark flooding just in the last few weeks starts to indicate that we are not only delaying costs and investments in cheaper energy, but we are also really delaying and elevating the costs of climate change for our households and communities as well. So I think, you know, the cost of repairing the damage done is huge.
And was there anything that surprised you?
Well, there are some good stories here, I think, in particular. It's important always to elevate. New York continues to invest significantly in clean water and in particular in the Environmental Protection Fund, which is something that the electeds from your neck of the woods have been good champions for, as have many of the allies we work with as organizations. Clean water is a fundamental human right, and it is not something that the federal administration in Washington, D.C. is investing in. The more that New York can do to protect our waterways, the better we and our future generations are. Also, we saw $1 billion invested or allocated in something called the Sustainable Future Fund, which is a fund for making our communities more resilient. That's going to have major impacts for the Catskills and Hudson Valley as well, for homes, households, energy efficiency, hopefully more heat pumps and retrofits, things that are going to hopefully help people understand and feel soon savings in and around those utility bills that are getting higher and higher. New York has also had a big year for distributed solar, and there are a lot of projects that are breaking ground in your region this summer. And I encourage people to learn about projects in their backyards. There's a lot of misinformation about utility solar out there right now in particular. Also battery storage. These are complex issues, and there's no easy black or white, but our state benefits when we build out our solar capacity and our storage capacity. And these will be big stories for the year to come as well.
Well, thinking about this most recent scorecard that was released this week, how do you hope people use the scorecard information?
I really believe that even when things are tense, that the scorecard is a fundamental part of good government. It helps us have the information we need to understand and hold our representatives to hold our elected officials accountable. And I really hope that there is a tool on the website, eany.org/scorecard, but you can navigate there from our homepage, that lets you look up your representative and find out their score. You can compare them to legislators by region. You can see how they are measuring up compared to other people in neighboring districts or across the state. And I encourage you to reach out and find out about their votes on certain issues. You can learn more about each of their votes, or simply ask them, most importantly, what they plan to work on this year. I think this is a really big opportunity, and your legislators are waiting to hear from you. So I encourage you to, if you don't know the name of your assembly member or your state senator, encourage you to take this as an opportunity to find that out too and learn a little bit more about their environmental record.
And looking ahead just a bit, you know, we're well into the second half of 2026, which feels quite wild to say out loud. And 2027 is not too far away. What do you foresee potentially being some of the biggest environmental issues that might be top of mind for state lawmakers for next year's legislative session?
I think that we have a lot to do in and around our energy planning as a state. New York State has released a new energy plan, and we are in the process as a state of trying to optimize the mix of energy to minimize harmful climate emissions, which means using more renewables, and also keeping that affordable for everybody across the state. And I think that's going to be the priority issue. That means we're going to be looking at a lot of renewable projects, utility solar projects. It means we're going to be confronting a lot of pressure around natural gas. And I think the Constitution pipeline and many issues that are pretty central to the Hudson Valley and the Catskills are going to be front and center, and I encourage people to pay attention, because the more natural gas we lock in, the harder it's going to be to move off of fossil fuels. I also think that in the era of the Trump administration, as they erode EPA protections for our water, that continuing to invest in clean water is going to be a very big issue. And one of the things we really enjoy working on with the elected officials from your region is on resilient agriculture and ensuring that we are doing more and more with the agricultural community, working directly with farmers and beyond to ensure that we are making it affordable, accessible, and worth their time and effort to be investing in the kinds of practices and materials that protect their land and their products and their income for the foreseeable future in a changing climate.
Well, folks can check out Environmental Advocates New York's latest environmental scorecard, as Vanessa mentioned, at eny.org/scorecard. We've been chatting with Vanessa Fagins-Turner, Executive Director of Environmental Advocates New York. Vanessa, thank you again so much for chatting.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
And coming up, Science Stories with Joe Johnson. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
On the next Radiolab.
The plane started rotating.
They were going 168 miles an hour.
Whoa.
How a plane crash in Nebraska.
Boom, everything exploded.
And a team of local doctors.
Neurosurgeons.
Urologists.
EMTs. Nurses.
Gave us the modern ER.
First head.
Neat.
Us Nebraskans are kind of like that.
One, two, three.
That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A few mysteries from the worlds of science and history. What can a 2,300-year-old batch of beer tell us about ancient brewing? Can butterflies carry memories from their caterpillar days? And NASA sending a robotic spacecraft to rescue an aging space telescope. Yes, it's time for Science Stories with Joe Johnson. Here he is speaking with our own Jason Dole.
So we've got three stories today, and the first one we're going to start with I call Old Beer. This are actually two stories that I recently noticed. Story number one comes from an archaeological dig in China. Scientists there were excavating a series of Qin-era tombs. This is from the Warring States period from 475 to 221 BC. And this actually led to the first Qin dynasty. That's where China got its name from. Now, in one of these tombs, archaeologists found a bronze vessel containing a little less than a gallon of a bluish-greenish fluid that they've identified as a brewed grain product, which is beer. And it's amazing that it's lasted for this long, that it's survived.
Dude, you're talking about 2,200-year-old
2,300.
Beer? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, 2,300-year-old beer. I don't think I'd want to drink it, though. But the second story we'll see about, though. But anyway, chemical analysis of the fluid showed that it contained over 2,400 different chemical compounds, along with starch grains, phytoliths, which are actually microscopic plant skeletons. They're small silica-based microscopic plant structures. They actually give plants their rigidity. They grow between the cells and in the cells. Yeast remains and other microscopic plant remains. And it also contains lactic acid and oxalic acid, which are products of brewing. You only get them when you brew stuff. This was apparently a cereal-based beverage made from broomcorn millet. Now, I know what millet is, but I had to look up broomcorn millet. It's actually just native to northern China, and it's a wild grain that was propagated. And they think there was some wheat or barley in there, too. Now, why was this preserved so long? Well, first of all, the local environment is very, very dry, okay? And they sealed, whoever put this in the tomb, sealed it with what they called a textile and organic material. And they weren't very clear on that. But I would think maybe pine tar or something like that. They literally sealed it up.
Beeswax or who knows?
Yeah, so that it the alcohol and the water didn't evaporate and no groundwater got in.
Wow.
And so this is the real deal. Now, normally they only find a residue of brewed beverages in tombs. So this is going to tell us a lot about brewing practices of the time, science, etc. And by the way, the oldest brewed material in China is about 10,000 years old.
Okay,
so this isn't even close. Now, it's probably bluish green because it was in the bronze, and bronze is copper and tin.
Right.
And copper tends to make things, you know, blue compounds. And so that's probably where the blue-green came from. But it'll be interesting to see what the final analysis tells us.
You know, and then after the final analysis, then come the culinary reconstructionists. Before long, you'll be seeing YouTube videos of people say, hey, here's this 2,300-year-old broomcorn beer.
There you go. Well, you're a little prescient about the second story, which actually comes from Smithsonian Magazine. This is about a 162-year-old bottle of Guinness Extra Stout that was recovered from a shipwreck in the English Channel. Now, the ship is the Mindaro, and it sank in November 1864. It collided with another ship in really dense fog, but it did sink with no loss of life. So there's a bright side to the story there.
Oh, good.
Remember, this is during the reign of Queen Victoria, and this is near the end of the U.S. Civil War. It's 162 years ago. Now, divers exploring the wreck found the bottle still sealed and in excellent condition. And so they have 162-year-old Guinness. Now, they realized what they had, that this was a sealed artifact kept in the dark at low temperature, you know, at the bottom of the ocean. It's dark and it's cold, which is perfect for, you know, storing something like this. They called it a flawlessly sealed time capsule of liquid history, which I thought was kind of poetic. Perfect conditions for preservation. Now, they were tempted to sample it, but eventually cooler heads prevailed and they sent it off to Leuven University in Belgium for analysis. If it turns out to be safe, they want to take a sip of this stuff.
Okay.
And there's actually more of it on the bottom of the ocean, too.
I mean,
ultimately,
somebody want to take a sip, but then also they're going to be doing chemical analysis.
Oh, yeah.
Investigation, studying. So this will be opened at some point for investigation.
It has been. They've taken a sample and they've sent it off to the university in Belgium for analysis. Like I said, they want to know if it's safe to drink, first of all. And then what they're going to try and do is they're going to try and recreate it. They're looking at the chemical analysis of it, as you said, and they're looking specifically at the yeast because different yeast will make different beers. And they're trying to like sample the DNA to see if they can find a modern match to it. And they're calling it Project Jurassic Beer.
Now, do you know, did they get a hold of the folks at Guinness? Because this company's still around.
Well, they did contact Guinness, and Guinness is interested. Now, they do say that they're going to go back and get more bottles of it, and they've promised a couple of them to Guinness. And so I would look for that on your grocery shelves coming up anytime now.
More than one bottle, that really opens it up to, you know, the scientific method, meaning everybody can practice reconstructing. You know, the Guinness can try it. This group of scientists can try it. This group of culinary experts. And then we'll see which one's the best. That's science.
I would take it from Guinness. So our second story is about butterflies. And the question here is, do butterflies remember being a caterpillar? This actually popped up in the popular press back in June. I cannot find the original paper. It said that it was presented to a conference, but I can't find the original paper to read it. And it may be because it's all about the work of a 10-year-old schoolboy from Kobe, Japan. Kid's name was Joe Nagai. And he's been fascinated with insects for years. In fact, he made hundreds of handwritten pages with his notes on his observations of insect behavior. And he eventually started raising these Asian swallowtail butterflies, really pretty little butterfly. And he raised them from eggs to the caterpillar stage, which is the larva, to the adult butterfly, which he then released into the wild. And he noticed one day that the wild butterflies flew away when he approached them, but his hand-raised butterflies actually flew towards him. And some actually landed on him and landed on his hand. So he thought to himself, do they remember their time as a caterpillar? Did they remember me from that? So for a little bio 101 here, to get from the caterpillar to the butterfly, the caterpillar has to go through metamorphosis. Caterpillar is the larval stage. It has to pupate in a chrysalis to undergo metamorphosis. And metamorphosis is when the caterpillar is just totally broken down. All of the body systems essentially dissolve.
Yeah,
with the exception of a small brain core, apparently, that may remember things. Different parts of the brain are eliminated and new parts of the brain grow, and all of the peripheral nerves. Because think about the anatomy of a caterpillar and think about the anatomy of a butterfly. Totally different, you know, different, you know, skill set.
Things have to be completely reconstituted.
Yeah, absolutely. And think about it. The brain that runs a caterpillar would not run the, you know, a butterfly. And so with the exception of this little brain core, everything gets remade. Joe got in touch with Dr. Martha Weiss, who is an entomologist from Georgetown University, and together they designed a simple experiment to test his hypothesis. He exposed caterpillars in the larval stage to the scent of lavender at the same time as he delivered a mild electronic pulse from a home muscle therapy device. I don't know if you've seen those electric devices that shock your muscles.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's what he used, because once again, he's on the other side of the world from Dr. Weiss, and they're, you know, communicating about this. Now, importantly, he also created a control group that were untrained. Now, the butterflies that resulted from the caterpillars were then placed in a Y-shaped tube. One side had lavender scent and one without. The control group split pretty evenly when flying into the maze, you know, on either side, but the experimental group overwhelmingly chose the unscented tunnel, avoiding the lavender.
They don't want to get shocked.
They don't want to get shocked, yeah. So, but here's the cool part. More surprisingly is that the descendants of his trained butterflies still chose to avoid lavender for at least two generations. Is this transgenerational memory inheritance? I mean, I've never heard of that, you know, where one generation can actually remember what happened to, or at least associate things from past generations.
But then that opens up the door to, is this even a function of memory as we understand it, as a neurological mental thing versus other things that are passed down genetically, you know, which that happens, you know, from generation to generation.
Right.
That's a whole additional conversation.
Yeah, that's the fascinating part about this for me. Wow. That's the really cool part about this for me. So once again, more research. Joe, by the way, wants to become a veterinarian when he grows up. He doesn't want to work with insects.
Okay, that's good. Well, and you've got something called Link to the Rescue. Link is in all caps. I can imagine this is not Ace, secret agent chimp Lancelot Link coming to save us. This is probably something much more practical.
Well, this is a spacecraft. This is a story that's been developing for about a year now. Back in July 2025, NASA calculated that the Swift Space Observatory, it's a space telescope, was losing altitude faster than they predicted. And they believe that recent solar activity might have accelerated its descent. In other words, the sun doesn't just put out light and energy, it puts out particles. And as those particles hit the spacecraft, they actually pushed it farther down into the atmosphere. They calculated that it would re-enter the atmosphere in August 2026, in other words, right about now. And they fixed that temporarily by realigning the spacecraft, the solar panels, to actually create less drag. So as it orbits, it's not going to be creating as much friction, and so it'll stay up there for longer. Now, Swift was launched in 2004, and it's designed to detect gamma ray bursts. And it also has UV, X-ray, and optical capabilities, too. The idea here is that the gamma ray burst is going to tell us that something important happened, and then swift means that it can swiftly turn to look at that with the X-rays and the gamma rays and, or, you know, all the other wavelengths that it can. It's actually been called Hubble's little brother, and it cost about $500 million. So they want to save it. It's been really, really useful tool for many, many different types of astronomers, and it's been credited with a lot of discoveries. So it's an important tool. Now, to save the observatory, NASA contracted with Catalyst Space to design and build a robot spacecraft to attach to Swift and boost it into a higher and therefore safer orbit. And they had to do this. They had to design it, build it, and get it ready to launch in 10 months, which is just a crazy short amount of time when it comes to stuff like this. And it's really cost effective too. And only, you know, it was about a $30 million contract.
That's a really tight time frame.
Now, Link is about 6 foot long, weighs about 900 pounds here on the Earth, and it's going to grab Swift using three robotic arms because the Swift observatory doesn't have a docking port because it was never meant to be docked with. And it's then going to boost the observatory into higher orbit using these electronic ion thrusters that are really cool. Not like a chemical rocket engine or even gas being vented. It's actually using electricity to move the spacecraft.
That's also interesting.
That is pretty cool stuff, yeah. So it was launched on July 3rd using a Pegasus rocket that launches from the underside of a NASA jet after being dropped at 40,000 feet. In other words, it drops from the bottom of a jet and then the rocket ignites and boosts it up into orbit. It made it to orbit, but it experienced a malfunction. Two of the reaction wheels, which are like flywheels inside that they speed up and slow down to actually point the spacecraft, they malfunctioned. They didn't work, okay? And so NASA used the thrusters on board to actually repoint, to stop the spin and to realign it. And then they sent up new software. They basically reprogrammed the spacecraft to not have to use these two wheels. And apparently everything is working well right now. They're going to have to make sure that everything's working properly. Then what they'll do is they'll actually realign the orbit of Link and they'll catch up to Swift sometime in late August. They don't have an exact timeline yet because, you know, some of the stuff that's happened. And then that boost phase is predicted to be somewhere between 2 and 3 months to put it up into a higher orbit and save this $500 million spacecraft.
It seems like, you know, Hubble was the notable one. It went on for like decades longer than it was originally
planned.
Still
is.
Here's this Swift now. It's been up there for 22 years.
Right.
And what do you think of this, that we keep finding, you know, ways to extend the life? I mean, Voyager's still out there and still talking back longer than anybody thought that it would be able to talk to us, now taking a day for communications to come back. What do you think about this? Like, just it seems to me to be a trend, maybe a good one, that there's additional use in life in these very expensive scientific devices.
Yeah, I think this speaks to how robust the spacecraft are, how well they're designed and how well they're built. You're right. It was supposed to have a 2-year mission. That's what they, you know, contracted for, but it's been going for, you know, 22 years now. And hopefully with this boost, it'll be going quite a longer time.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming to us with these great science stories.
It's always a pleasure to talk about science.
Thanks to Jason Dole and science guy, science expert Joe Johnson. Coming up, we're eating upstate at Oyster Party, a little coastal flavor. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Hey folks, I'm Alzo Slade from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's the NPR News Quiz where we make fun of the news and chat with funny people like Hasan Minhaj.
Your parents were not up for you being a comic.
Yeah, they're not. They weren't really into it, but that's because they loved me.
Make your parents proud by staying up to date on the news with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Well, most people don't associate oysters with the Catskills, but Oyster Party, which started as a Brooklyn-based oyster catering business, now has a location in Woodstock, serving fresh oysters, lobster rolls, and other New England-inspired seafood. For this week's Eating Upstate, Aaron Shearer takes us to Oyster Party to find out how a business built around bringing people together over oysters is, wait for it, making waves upstate.
Since 2011, Oyster Party has catered events and hosted pop-ups serving oysters and lobster rolls, alongside fantastic local beverages throughout the Catskills, the Hudson Valley, and the greater tri-state area. Originating in Brooklyn, Oyster Party opened a brick-and-mortar location last November on Route 28 next to the Hotel Dillon in Woodstock. Oyster Party is the subject of today's Eating Upstate. Kyle Needham grew up in Hampton, New Hampshire, a coastal town near Portsmouth, where seafood was a part of everyday life.
So I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire called Hampton. It's a seacoast town. It's just south of Portsmouth, which is more well-known now, I think. And just growing up near the water and the seacoast and in New England in general, just, you know, I think seafood was always around. I didn't, you know, it was just, I don't know, more popular as any other food. It's not like we ate a lot of oysters, though, growing up.
He worked for Whole Foods in Boston before relocating to New York City, where he worked in the seafood department of the Columbus Circle Whole Foods. This started him on a path to a career in seafood.
Yeah, I would say by accident, because I actually worked at Whole Foods before I moved to New York and Boston, but I worked in a different department. And I worked in the prepared foods department. And then a friend of mine who worked in the seafood department in Boston was going to New York to open the store as a manager in the seafood. And he said, anytime you come, you can have a job. And I was like, I don't want to work in the seafood department. And he said, okay. But when I went to Columbus Circle, it was so massive.
After Whole Foods, Needham moved on to Wild Edibles, a seafood wholesaler based out of the Bronx. By 2011, he was working as a bartender in Williamsburg. Working in the food world in New York City, he observed that servers didn't know how to shuck oysters. Drawing on his experience and connections in the seafood industry, he launched Oyster Party that same year.
They're still not, honestly. It's a skill. Like anything, you just spend enough time doing it. You can open oysters, but to even to open them correctly so you don't mangle the meat, to puncture it, and knowing, you know, what a good oyster looks like and things of that nature. 2011, it started. I was actually, directly before it started, I was bartending in Williamsburg, and I just asked all my regulars if they would come to an oyster and lobster roll party, because I still had the connection from the wholesale seafood company that I worked at in Manhattan, and I was able to get oysters and lobster easily. And so they were like, yeah, it sounds great. So I got like 100 people to come, and it was crazy. We sold like 1,500 oysters and like, you know, 10 pounds of lobster made in like an hour and a half or something crazy.
In 2013, after the birth of his first child, he moved to the Hudson Valley, first to Accord, then Kingston. For the next decade or so, Oyster Party continued to cater to events and organized pop-ups in New York City, the Hudson Valley, and the greater tri-state area, including the Smorgasburg Market in Brooklyn. Needham had no intention of opening a brick-and-mortar location of Oyster Party until he was drawn to the space on Route 28 near Woodstock.
You know, Field and Supply, to doing pop-ups at, you know, Westkill in the early days, and Rose Hill, Hudson Valley Brewery, places like that. We've been with them for a long time. I wouldn't say that we wanted to, because we've always said we didn't want it, and why we didn't. I kept driving by this spot on 28, and I was, you know, I either thought, it's way too much money or it's already rented. But I kept driving by and it said, you know, for lease. And so, you know, I finally called the number and talked to the owner, and he told me to come by and look at it. And I had known the space before, because previously it was a cafe, and, you know, it was like a perfect size. If we were going to open up anything, the size is what we were looking for. And being on 28, I thought, hey, that's, you know, a heavily trafficked road. This could be something good. And the price was right, and the space was great, and so we ended up signing the lease.
Oyster Party opened in Woodstock in November 2025. Oyster Party currently sources its oysters from Righteous Foods, located in Brooklyn. They serve wine from Fjord Vineyards, located in Milton in Ulster County, cider from Rose Hill Farm, located in Red Hook, Dutchess County, and their beer from Westkill Brewing, located in Westkill in Greene County. They continue to cater events and host pop-ups, and in the future, Needham hopes to open another location either in the Catskills or in the Hudson Valley.
We figured we wanted to open up sooner, but as you start to open a restaurant, you know, even on a small scale, things happen. So we never wanted to rush it, and we still had our whole season going on. So instead of trying to open up and failing during you know, September, October, having to change hours, we decided, hey, why don't we open up in November? And so we did, and just with a long runway to really try to get it right for the, both the customer experience. You know, we knew our quality was, has always been there. We're never worried about that. But just, you know, the ins and outs of running a restaurant was fairly new to us. It's just different than our everyday operation. Tons of weddings every year. We do private events at people's homes. We do corporate events at, you know, offices, both here in the Hudson Valley and Manhattan, and honestly anywhere in Jersey. And we do pop-up wineries, breweries, cideries, or restaurants. You know, anyone that wants to collaborate, we usually say yes if it piques our interest, to be honest. You know, we really are enjoying where we are right now. I think if we could have another location like this, slightly bigger, I think we want a little bit bigger. You've been there. There's only about 12 seats or so inside. So we can have a slightly expanded, you know, dining room, maybe 12, and maybe a slightly expanded menu. That would be great, too. So maybe, you know, another location somewhere in the Hudson Valley or Catskills for that matter. No. If you haven't been down, you know, I just invite everyone to come down and have some oysters and lobster rolls, some wine, beer, or if you don't drink, you know, and the soft drinks. It's great. It's just a chill sort of unexpected, you know, gem. That's what we want to be like in the Hudson Valley, you know.
Oyster Party is located at 1802 State Route 28 in Woodstock. I'm Erin Shear. Eating Upstate is a production of Radio Catskill.
Next, we'll meet the founder of StoryCorps and learn how Connect 250 is bringing Americans together one conversation at a time. This is Radio Catskill.
After killing millions of animals worldwide, the highly contagious H5N1 avian flu has arrived in Australia and New Zealand.
We could have a greatly accelerated push to extinction for a lot of species.
And Mary Louise Kelly, the threat avian flu poses to Australia and New Zealand's unique wildlife, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
It's Radio Catskill. In 2024, Radio Catskill partnered with StoryCorps to foster connection across political divides through their One Small Step program. Now, in celebration of the 250th birthday of America, StoryCorps is collaborating with NPR's Morning Edition to present Connect 250, a time capsule of American voices and stories. Each participant will be matched with a stranger from across the country for a 40-minute conversation about their lives. Participants can choose to preserve their conversation in the Library of Congress, and the window to sign up ends on August 31st. Radio Catskill's Ronald Kelson spoke with Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps, to talk about the Connect 250 project and the StoryCorps mission.
So you founded StoryCorps all the way back in 2003. It began with just a talking booth in Grand Central Terminal in New York City. Did you think that StoryCorps would become this national nonprofit with thousands of participants across the country?
I didn't. When we started StoryCorps, it was a time-bound project that we were planning on ending after a decade. And here we are 23 years later. And I'm hoping that I'll be working on this until they put me in a pine box. You know, this is a lifetime effort. It's, you know, someone once said to me, actually very recently said to me, you know, StoryCorps is playing in the sandbox of humanity. It's just about who we are as human beings. So it's endlessly fascinating. I'm not someone with a very long attention span, but this has kept my attention intensely for more than two decades now.
Sure. And, you know, staying back in 2003, what do you think were some of the reasons you felt the need to start StoryCorps, and have those changes adapted to today?
Yeah, no, StoryCorps is constantly adapting. And as you well know, working on One Small Step, I was talking to the person who founded StoryCorps with me, employee number one, a couple of weeks ago. And he reminded me that he had asked me, what, you know, why are you doing this? And I said, you know, I had been a radio documentary producer for decades before starting StoryCorps. And I said, doing, you know, interviews with people. And I said, you know, I get to run around the country talking to people who I haven't talked before. And the microphone gives you the license to say things, to ask things that you've never, as you well know, that you've never talked about before. It's an incredible gift. And also, you know, honoring people and having the gift of seeing people kind of rise up when they're asked these questions. So I said I wanted everyone to have the experience that I had of being able to ask questions like this. So that's one of the many reasons that I started StoryCorps. I think we are constantly adapting. You know, 10 years ago, we created an app, so it's possible to do a StoryCorps interview and with one tap upload it to the Library of Congress. We have One Small Step, which was the first time we started working with strangers, in that case, as you know, across political divides. And Connect 250 is another innovation for us, and that's this incredible, you know, platform that is matching strangers, kind of like a dating app, to have this like, hey, America, meet America experience, as you said, a time capsule of who we are at the 250th of America.
Moving up a little bit in time here, how do you think the pandemic exacerbated the need for StoryCorps and its programming?
Well, when the pandemic hit, that was the first time we created a way for people to be matched and have StoryCorps conversations over video, because obviously we couldn't do face-to-face conversations anymore. You know, I think part of what we're doing with Connect 250, and we do want this, I think, maybe the last interview that I do on Connect 250. Most of them were before July 4th, but the platform is still open, and we want people to join the platform. I mean, I think that, you know, we live in a country where a lot of people feel isolated, lonely. There's a lot of distrust. So what we're trying to do is help, you know, create proximity between people and, you know, remind people of that truth that, you know, all of us, no matter where we are on the political spectrum, no matter who we are, the vast majority of us are basically good. So this is StoryCorps is, I like to think, kind of a hope machine, a proximity machine, and an empathy machine. And again, we're seeing with Connect 250, like it completely, like it's beyond expectations. We had more than 10,000 people pre-register before we opened up in early July. We have interviews coming in every minute between people. And if I can, you know, we know the Catskills well, and are thrilled to be on Radio Catskill. And if you want to be part of this experiment in human connection, you can go to connect250.org and sign up. No more pre-registrations. We're open for business, and we'd love to have you be part of this kind of dating app for democracy, I guess you could say.
Dating app for democracy. That's special branding right there.
Made up right here.
There you go.
You heard it here first.
Yes. So about specifically the Connect 250 program now, why the semi-quincentennial? Why now? StoryCorps, we've talked about it, the One Small Step program, other programs are not necessarily doing or trying to accomplish the same thing, but why the 250th anniversary? Why did you choose that to be the launching point for this specific program?
So I like to think that StoryCorps tries to do beautiful things. And sometimes we do beautiful things last minute. And this was a last minute effort. I think that we at StoryCorps were looking at all of the offerings around America 250 and were kind of underwhelmed, very partisan, kind of very, very loud celebrations. And we wanted to do something in the spirit of StoryCorps and public broadcasting that's more a whisper in your ear. So in about 6-7 weeks, we developed this platform and we launched it. The idea was that America deserves to be honored in ways at the 250th, and we wanted to do something that was going to survive until the 350th. So, as we both said, you know, it's kind of a time capsule that our great 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 grandkids can look back on to understand who we are as Americans. And I think, and I hope that it's a better representation and a more true representation of what they might get if they looked at Twitter, X, or, you know, some of the 24-hour cable news. I mean, it's just who we are. As you know, StoryCorps brings out the best in us. All the interviews go to the Library of Congress. This is, you know, everybody becomes part of American history. So it's an attempt to do a more realistic, a gentler, and more human take on the 250th.
Yeah, you mentioned the celebrations that are happening all over the country the entire year. A lot of them more overtly patriotic, to say the least, whether it's reenactments, rededications, historical lectures, and a ton more. How is the Connect 250 program, in a way, also celebrating the American 250th anniversary in a similar way?
Well, I mean, I think what we were focused on was kind of what was going on in Washington. And someone described it as storm, sweat, and fire over the, you know, 4th of July weekend. But that's, you know, look, it's total, there's room for all kinds of different celebrations. And, you know, to me, StoryCorps, participating in StoryCorps is a patriotic act. It's, you know, it takes some courage. People come into these interviews a little bit nervous, as you well know, and they come out almost to a person, friends. So I think that, you know, the purpose of StoryCorps in general, and especially Connect 250, is to strengthen the bonds between us. And, you know, when you talk about some of the, you know, we talked about isolation and loneliness, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories, all kinds of stuff is rising up because of the fact that we don't have proximity to each other. You know, there are studies that show we're half as likely to know our neighbors now than we were 10, 15 years ago. So it's just, you know, to me, the most patriotic act you can do is to, you know, love your neighbor. And that's what we're trying to do with Connect 250.
What kind of impact do you want Connect 250 to have on American society and also all of StoryCorps programs?
Well, I, you know, it goes back to what I just said. You know, I think that we hope that Connect 250 and StoryCorps as a whole just draws us a little bit closer together. And you know, the one of the things about Connect 250 that I think is interesting and that we're seeing is what's called the stranger on the train phenomena. That sometimes it's easier to talk to someone you don't know than it is to talk to someone you do know. I mean, I've done two interviews and I did one yesterday, and I'm not a crier at all, but I broke down in the interview, and I don't quite understand what it is about StoryCorps that makes that happen. But there is something about, I mean, it's almost when you're having a conversation with someone, you know, and it's kind of the opposite of reality TV. No one comes to StoryCorps to get rich or famous or, you know, it's just an act of generosity and love. And, you know, when you're doing something story, you know, there is a certain purity to StoryCorps, I like to think. You're kind of walking on holy ground when you have that kind of conversation.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we sign off?
No, but I'm grateful to Radio Catskill for being a partner on One Small Step. And I do hope that people will come to connect250.org and be a part of this. I can speak from personal experience. It's amazing. And we want as many people from the Catskills as possible to be in the record for 100 years from now for our great, great grandkids to understand that we're not who you might think we are if you tuned in and looked at social media.
That's Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps, who, in collaboration with NPR's Morning Edition, is presenting Connect 250, a program that matches participants with a stranger from across the country for a 40-minute conversation about their lives. The window to sign up ends August 31st. You can find out more information at connect250.org. Dave, thank you so much for joining me, and good luck the rest of the way.
Ron, thank you so much.
So proud to be a partner with StoryCorps. And again, if you want to sign up for this project, go to connect250.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Less humid today with clouds yielding to sun, a high 81. Partly cloudy tonight, low 56. And tomorrow, sunshine and a mix with a few clouds, high 81. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. It's 11 o'clock.